Welcome to the Weekly Fix, presented by the Asia Society and the Far Eastern Economic Review, with the latest headlines out of Asia and expert commentary you'll only get here. Today, we'll discuss the $7.6 billion loan for Pakistan just approved by the IMF and the looming environmental meltdown on the Tibetan Plateau. We'll also share with you excerpts from a conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist John Burns on what it was like covering the Cultural Revolution in China. I'm Deanna Lee. Thanks for joining us. It's Tuesday, November 25th. Many are relieved in Pakistan now that the country has won final approval for a $7.6 billion loan from the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, to help stave off a possible economic meltdown there. Kamal Siddiqui is an editor at the News International in Karachi and a Far Eastern Economic Review, or FEAR, contributor. Kamal, what is Pakistan facing that has made this loan so crucial?
Pakistan is facing two major challenges. The first is obviously problems coming in from the international economic crunch. But at the same time, Pakistan is facing a domestic challenge through the war on terror, because what's happening is that increased terror attacks are driving away investors and also putting a halt to a lot of investment plans that foreign investors are trying to make into Pakistan.
So what does this loan now do?
This loan is important because entering an IMF program for Pakistan means an endorsement by the IMF of Pakistan's economic policies. So that's the most important thing for Pakistan, to be seen as taking the right steps to repair its economic situation. Apart from that, we are looking at some balance of payment problems. We're looking at Pakistan's foreign exchange reserves going down. So this money coming in will help Pakistan in terms of meeting its import requirements.
Most importantly, oil, which has recently reached all-time highs in price, correct?
While we have seen a reduction in international oil prices, there are lots of issues that are connected to it in terms of Pakistan. And oil is something that drives the economy in terms of prices of very basic commodities. So that is why if oil prices are stabilized, the next thing we will see is that prices will also be stabilized, because a lot of inflation is pushed by higher oil prices. I think the other area that we're looking at in terms of the IMF is the pressure on the rupee will decrease. Because in the past 2-3 months, we have seen the rupee depreciate by as high as 25% as compared to the dollar. So a lot of raw materials come in from abroad for Pakistan, for things that are locally made, in addition to our imported items, which include things like edible oil. And we do produce wheat, but we also import wheat, which is our basic staple. So with the IMF helping us with our foreign exchange reserves, stabilizing them, and there will be less pressure on the Pakistan rupee versus the dollar. And that is why we will see that the imports that are increasingly becoming costly will also stabilize in terms of their prices.
Kamal, what about the effect of the loan on the political picture in Pakistan?
It will strengthen the hand of President Zardari, in the sense that finally we will be seeing some good news on the economic front. Because so far what's happened is, ever since he took oath of office as Pakistan's president, there has been an economic downturn, both in terms of the international downturn, which he is not responsible for, but domestically we have seen a crisis of confidence in his government. So in that sense, this is the first positive step towards trying to repair the damage that has been caused to the economy and bring it back on a sound footing.
Kamal Siddiqui, thank you very much for joining us from Pakistan. You can read Kamal's column, Pakistan Says Yes to the IMF, at www.feer.com. That's FEER.com. Now for you tourists out there, we've got Michael Zhao from the Center on U.S.-China Relations at Asia Society, who's just returned from the Yellow River source area of the Tibetan Plateau. There is a very serious story here, and as Michael points out, while focus has been on Tibet, for example, in the lead-up to the Olympics, there's another crisis brewing here that we really can't afford to not pay attention to. Michael, tell us what that is.
Right. Well, this region is also known as Asia's Water Tower. By that, I mean there are so many great mighty river systems coming off the plateau of glaciers. For instance, the Yellow, the Yangtze, the Mekong, Brahmaputra, the Ganges, to name just a few. And these river systems feed water in terms of both agriculture and industries and stuff to as many as 2 billion people in Southeast Asia, South Asia, and the whole subcontinent. And by this trip, I can definitely feel that people are talking about it while they don't associate the changes with the term global warming, but they are seeing the glaciers retreating, they are seeing grassland degrading, which means they are having a big problem with their nomadic way of life, which has been there for thousands of years. So they are having lower incomes. Some of them don't even raise sheep. In one area we visited, the nomads have to move 12 times a year, which is crazy. While normally they would move twice a year in the summer and in the winter to rotate the pastures to let, you know, one rest and the other to graze and stuff. But now in this area, the grassland is slowly turning into a desert. The effects are not only affecting the local people, which is why we should pay attention, because this area is more sensitive than other areas in terms of the feedback to the global warming. So what they are dealing now is going to be what we have to do to deal with in the next decade or two.
So what can be done?
First of all, the big players in this global game, I would say, would have to sit down and talk about how to seriously act. There's been a lot of finger pointing between, say, China and the U.S., but these two countries at least should sit down and say, okay, we have to deal with it together.
It's time for Heard At Asia Society. We recently had in New York a program called Covering the Cultural Revolution, a conversation with John Burns. Burns is a well-renowned New York Times reporter, but his association with China began in the early 1970s when the Toronto Globe and Mail sent him to cover the Cultural Revolution. Here he talks about some of the early challenges.
I think the most important lesson I learned in the early time that I was in China was to disregard one precept that had been offered to me by one prominent academic in this country, which was, don't judge China by your own standards, judge it by China's standards. A precept which was later interpreted by an American ambassador to China in my second tour as being equivalent to check your brains at the border. And I did. I checked my brains at the border. And for the first year, I was loath to apply my own judgments. And that led me into all kinds of nonsense. I went down to one of these May 7th cadre schools, which we just saw in the photographs, re-education school in the countryside about 200 kilometers outside of Peking, as we used to call it then, where I was introduced to the man who, more than any other, was responsible for China's hydrogen bomb. And he was literally clearing out a pig pen and explained to me that he was an ignorant man until he was given a chance to be educated under Chairman Mao's great teaching of going down to the countryside. And I would hate to see the story I wrote on that. But when, over a period of some, for its naivety, for its lack of perspective, and its lack of courage, but eventually the accumulation of evidence that what was at hand was not a great noble human experiment, but one of the great repressions of the 20th century, the evidence, though episodic, sporadic, partial, was so overwhelming that I decided, however disadvantaged I was by all the restrictions that the Chinese placed on me, I had one great advantage over all the people who were reading what I was writing, which was I was there and I had 2 eyes and 2 ears. And to trust those, and to trust, in effect, my own instincts and my own judgments.
Finally, for our featured event in Asia this week, if you happen to be in Mumbai on November 26th at 6 p.m., go to the American Center Auditorium, where Asia Society and the American Center are presenting Gary Seymour talking about non-proliferation challenges facing the Obama administration. Seymour, with the Council on Foreign Relations, will be talking about the nuclear challenges that the new administration will face and ways in which it might deal with them. That's it for this edition of the Weekly Fix, brought to you by Asia Society and the Far Eastern Economic Review. For more news and resources, all Asia-related, go to www.asiasociety.org and www.fear.com. Thanks for joining us, and please tune in to the Weekly Fix starting again next Tuesday.